So my talk has two parts. In the first part of the talk, I want to talk about some interesting data that comes from neuroscience where people observe some really strong and weird correlations and try to explain the data in terms of hidden variables to convince you of the power of hidden variables. And secondly, I then want to turn to this field of deep learning, which generates correlations and is a statistical modeling framework using hidden variables. And I'll connect it at the end to RG. But I'll spend a lot of time talking about sort of the background of what deep learning is, since you might not have seen it before. And I'll emphasize different things than if you went and listened to a talk in a computer science department. I'll emphasize the aspects of it that I think are most relevant to physicists that might want to work on problems. So let me start with the first part. And I just want to give you a little bit of background in neuroscience so you can have something to think about when we're looking at some data. So I'm going to look at data that comes from the retina. So this is a schematic picture of the retina. Basically, what happens is you have light. It comes in. It gets detected by the photoreceptors, which are up here at the top. Then there's a network, a sort of feed-forward network of neurons that pass information down to this bottom layer. This is a type of cell called a ganglion cell. And these neurons fire spikes, action potentials, and they send all of the information down the optic nerve to the brain. And these spikes are all of the information that the brain gets about the visual input. And it turns out that these days, you can record from a very large population of these ganglion cells, these spiking ganglion cells, in a live retina. So basically, you take the retina out, and you put it in a dish. You show it, a movie of your choice because it needs to look at something, and you can use what's called a multi-electrode array to pick up the spiking activity of all of these different cells. And this is a really old figure. At this point, people are starting to work with electrode arrays of 1,000 to 4,000 electrodes, so that you can really pick up the activity of thousands of neurons acting simultaneously. Then the question is, you do this, you pick up all this activity, what are you going to do with it? So the first thing that you might do is make a plot where you put cell number on one axis, you have time on the other axis, and you put a dot whenever the cell fires a spike. This is called a raster plot. And to simplify the data, you can bin time here in 20 millisecond bins, and you can convert the population state into a binary vector. So you put a 1 whenever a cell fires a spike and a 0 otherwise. And this loses a bit of information in the jitter of exactly where the spike was. Also, that you lose information of, perhaps the cell actually fired twice in this short time, but that happens pretty rarely. Okay, so you can collect this big set of patterns that come out of the retina. And you can then start studying the distribution. Think of this as a probability distribution of the joint state of this large population of neurons. And what the group of people at Princeton working on this did was they made what's called a ZIF plot. So they ordered all the different states in terms of how frequent they were, and they ranked them. And then they plotted log rank versus the log frequency. And what they find is, as they look at populations of neurons that are bigger and bigger, you end up with a power law. And the slope is approximately -1 here. So frequency is inversely proportional to rank. OK. This is something that was that's called Zipf's law. And it was first found in the 1940s in the distribution of word usage in human language. And you might wonder, OK, so fine. Why is this particular power law interesting? And it turns out that there's a direct connection between seeing Zipf's law and identifying a system to be at a critical point. And I just want to give you a sketch of how that works. The basic idea is I have some distribution of activities from all of these neurons, and I can write it like this and define the energy of any state as just minus log probability in my data. Okay. Then if I think in the microcanonical ensemble, and I just have the entropy as the log density of states, and the cumulative density of states, asymptotically equal to the density of states. Then if you think about it, the ranking of a pattern in its ordering is just the cumulative density of states evaluated at its energy. And if you turn this around, that means that the entropy is the log rank of a pattern. Okay. So if you take these two ingredients, and then you take a distribution that is of the form of Zipf's law here with a exponent alpha greater than 1, you end up with the statement that energy is exactly linear in energy. And with alpha equals 1, it's just energy equals entropy. And this is a weird state of affairs because then that means the specific heat is divergent, so the system is in some sense sitting at a critical point. Okay, so this is kind of a roundabout argument that this data looks like it comes from a system that is at a critical point, but it's a weird critical point. Another thing that you can do that maybe is a bit more direct is to try and model the distribution of the neural activity. And this is, again, the group at Princeton, where they fit a pairwise maximum entropy model. So they say, I want to exactly reproduce the mean activities of the neurons and their pairwise correlations, but I want my distribution to be otherwise as unconstrained as possible, thereby maximizing its entropy. And if you do that, you end up with a model that looks like an Ising model, but you have to fit the H's and fit the J's to reproduce the observed correlations. So you can do that, and then you end up with a model of the data. So what you can next do is you can stick in a fictitious temperature here. So the temperature of the real distribution is T equals 1, but you can put in a T here, and you can compute whatever thermodynamic quantities you want. And here they compute the specific heat as a function of this fictitious temperature. And what they find is that there is a peak in the specific heat that grows and moves closer to T equals 1 as you look at larger and larger populations of neurons. So this is a second indication that you can think of these distributions that are coming out of the retina as being sitting at a critical point. The data is the activities of neurons coming out of the retina. So yeah, a neural network.
So it's affecting the
network. Yeah.
Is there a dimension to that energy?
Here, it's fully connected. So you can have a JIJ between any pair of neurons, and you're fitting all of those, roughly n squared parameters. This is all well and good. My goal in the next few slides is to convince you that, it could be that the retina is finely tuned to be sitting at a critical point and doing this intentionally, or it could be that there's some natural mechanism that leads to these kinds of distributions based on the setup of the problem. And I want to advocate for the latter in terms of having hidden variables. So I want to give you a toy problem because oftentimes people are surprised about this before it's obvious. So let me imagine a physicist model of the system where I have some light intensity from the movie that is fluctuating between bright and dark, but is uniform in space. This is called a full field flicker experiment. And it impinges on these neurons, and these neurons then respond based on what the current light intensity is with some probability, but they do so independently. And so I get a sequence of zeros and ones. And then I start again. I start with a new light intensity, and I generate another state of the system. So this is just to say, for a given intensity, the distribution factorizes, and I can write it in this way if I want. But the full distribution, I have to integrate out this intensity. Certainly doesn't factorize, and in this toy problem, only depends on the state of the spins through m. So now you can imagine, I have an n here. If I have a large population of neurons, I can just do the simplest saddle point evaluation. And as long as my distribution of Q is broad enough, you get that if you define energy as minus log of this marginal probability, the energy function takes this form. This is, you know, a first year, you know, StatMech homework problem. And, you know, you'll recognize this as, you know, the entropy associated to the magnetization M. So for free in this system, basically independent of what the distribution of the intensities Q was, you're going to get energy equals entropy, and therefore Zipf's law and criticality and all of this stuff. So here, just to show you that, I've plotted energy versus entropy for a population of 100 toy neurons with a Gaussian distribution of Q. And if I make the width too narrow, I don't get energy linear in entropy. But once it's broad enough, I do. And I can change it by, you know, two orders of magnitude, and it doesn't really change anything. So this is a really robust mechanism to generate these highly correlated Zipfian type distributions. And of course, this was just a toy model, but the mechanism really holds quite generally. I'm not going to show you, you know, a derivation, but you can have heterogeneity, you can have conditional interactions, you can have multiple hidden variables. And you basically get this from an application of the Gardner-Ellis theorem from large deviations theory. So let me just show you two examples where I took some neurons that are still conditionally independent, but have their own quenched H that determines how sensitive they are to the stimulus. You know, some neurons could even be anti-sensitive, for example. And then when you make a Zipf plot, you get this, you know, very nice slope of minus one straight line. You can also have a system that's not conditionally independent, so you have conditional interactions here. And when you fluctuate beta, you end up with this nice, yeah.
Can you say again what
those mean? So you take all the patterns that, you know, you're generating samples, and you have some pattern of, you know, up and down, and you find the pattern that happened the most often. This one happened 500 times, so that gets rank one. This one is 400 times, rank two. So you order them by that ranking, and then you plot the log rank versus the log frequency that you observe them. Okay, so this shows that you can really robustly get these signatures of really strong correlations by having fluctuating hidden variables. And I guess I should also mention that the disorder that is added here is actually beneficial in the sense that if I had tried to make a Zipf plot of the toy model before, you wouldn't get a nice straight line, but you get steps where the slope of the staircase is minus one. Okay. So you can see this in many different situations. Before, I was talking about a population of neurons acting simultaneously. You can even look at the state of a single neuron that's firing take a window of time and just binarize its own spike pattern. And if you give a stimulus that is fluctuating, so sometimes you drive the neuron you know, pretty hard, sometimes you don't, when you marginalize it out, you get the same kind of signature. Okay, so you know, you might say, well, okay, you showed me that you can write this distribution in terms of, you know, some, you know, hidden fluctuating field, but, you know, I know from day one that I can do a Hubbard-Strachanovich transformation and, you know, write an interacting system, you know, like the fully connected Ising model in terms of, you know, a mean field. So did you do anything different? You know, isn't this just doing something like this? And the answer is that it is different because the fields that you get out of doing a Hubbard-Strachanovich transformation have an n in the exponent, and that changes the saddle point. So these are actually fundamentally different kinds of distributions, and you'll never see something like Zipf's law in the, you know, in an Ising model. And this kind of thing shows up in large-scale thermodynamic signatures of the system. So you can look at the mutual information between two halves of the system and ask how it scales. And if you are away from the critical point, the mutual information saturates at some finite value. For the mean field Ising model, if you're at the critical point, you get a 1/4 log n divergence. And for these distributions that I'm talking about, instead of a 1/4, you actually get a half log n. So in that sense, they're sort of twice as correlated as you know, a mean field Lyson model at its critical point. You can also put in an n dependence into the distribution of the fluctuating fields. And if you do that, you can continuously tune the coefficient in front of the log. So there are no special numbers here.
So each information is between two, just a bipartition, but every variable is connected like in a fully connected way.
That's right. Exactly. OK, so let me go back to the neural data for a little bit. This idea was taken up by the group of Peter Latham at the Gatsby, where he took experimental data from a movie that was about 4 seconds long and then just repeated over and over and over again. So you could build up marginal distributions and you could build up conditional distributions at particular points during the repetition of the movie. And what he found is that if you look at the marginal distribution, you get this very nice ZIF plot. But if you look at, you know, the conditional distribution at particular times during the repeat, you don't get this nice Ziffian thing. So it emerges due to mixing all of these different distributions. And he also found that a similar kind of effect is at work in word usage, which is the original place that Ziff found this result. So if you look at all of the words, you get Ziff's law, but if you break up the words by parts of speech, so adjectives and prepositions, for any given part of speech, you don't have that. And again, by mixing things together, you get Ziff's law out. Okay, so this experiment is great, but this was done actually for a full field flicker stimulus, like the toy example that I gave you. And a lot of the examples where people see this have more complicated stimuli, and I wanted to see whether, first of all, whether the same thing happened. So I got data from people that work on their larval salamander, and this is a sort of naturalistic movie that a larval salamander expects to see. And if you look at the responses of the neurons, you get this beautiful Ziff's law. If you look at the conditional responses at various times, you don't. But sometimes you do. I wanted to sort of, tease this apart a bit more to see whether this mixing really is what's going on. So the first thing that you can do, to figure out the mechanistic origins of this correlational structure is you can take the data for all of these different repeats, and you can shuffle it up. So you can take the response of neuron 1 on trial 1 and put it together with neuron 2 on trial 7 and so on. So you break all the conditional correlations. And if you do that, the Ziff plot is completely unchanged, and even the conditional Ziff plots are unchanged, and they've gotten out of sync somehow. So this says that conditional correlations are not required to generate this. So you can think of this as independent neurons that are being driven by the stimulus, and that's enough to give you this. But I also wanted to see whether somehow they were adapted or tuned very precisely in their individual response properties. Since we have repeats, we can look at within the repeat, just get a rate or a probability of firing, and then you can just generate data from the inhomogeneous Poisson process, and you can mess up the rate. So you can change the effective signal to noise ratio, so the actual response probability is in black, but you can increase the SNR or in red, or decrease it in blue, and then generate data and see whether you've screwed things up. And when you do that, what you find if you extract the Ziff exponent, you see that if you increase the signal to noise ratio, you preserve the Ziff-like behavior for a while, but if you decrease it, you lose it pretty quickly. So this. You can think of this G as kind of like tuning the width of the intensity distribution that I was talking about, and a couple slides back where I said if the distribution is too narrow, that affects the saddle point. You lose the behavior. That's sort of what's going on here. But if you increase it, not much happens. Okay, so I hope that I've convinced you that. That using hidden variables to generate structure and data is quite powerful, and it might be what's going on for observations of things like criticality in this neural data. And you know, what you might want to do next then is to actually model the distribution itself with hidden variables. So you know, actually you know, fit parameters of a model that has hidden variables to reproduce the distribution that you see, instead of having something like an Ising model that has direct interactions that everything needs to be very carefully tuned to put it at a critical point. And that leads me into thinking about the next part of my talk. So this is this problem of learning generative models, if you will, with hidden variables is a subset of this big field of deep learning. So I next want to move on to that. I'm not going to go back and actually model the neurons with this in this talk. What I want to do instead is give you kind of an introduction to what's going on in this field, because you've probably you know, seen an article here and there about it and thought, you know, this looks interesting, but I can't really tell what they're doing. And you know, there's a good reason for that, and that's that this term means a lot of things now. It doesn't mean just one thing. It's a huge class of techniques, and roughly speaking, they're unified by the idea of learning multiple levels of representation from your data. And the reason you're hearing about it these days is that it's really you know, been a revolution in things like object recognition and in speech recognition. And more recently, people have been doing, you know, some really state-of-the-art things with things like reinforcement learning. And you know, so for many years, the progress in these things like tasks like object recognition were sort of slow and steady. Then deep learning came, and boom, there was a big drop in error and a, you know, huge progress. So you know, you can now use, you know, speech to text, you know, and it actually works basically. You know, basically any you know, any tech company on the map is doing it these days. And one perspective that I will emphasize that comes from Yoshua Bengio is that you can think of all of the techniques as trying to learn features of your data with the prior assumption that there are a hierarchy of underlying factors giving rise to the structure in the data. So this is, you know, a plot of that where you see some low-level features that look like oriented gabors, and then they build up into eyes and ears and noses, which build up into faces, and then you can, you know, decode whose face is in the picture or something like that. I want to show you a couple of, you know, really neat examples of amazing performance. This is an old paper now. I'm showing it to you because it was the paper that brought deep learning really into the spotlight, where it sort of smashed all the records on this ImageNet challenge. So this is a challenge where you're supposed to, you know, figure out what's in the image. It's, you know, a complex, you know, big color image, and there are something like 10,000 different categories. And if you get it in the top five, you're called correct. So it does pretty well. The pink is correct, and the blue is incorrect. And these are its top five guesses. And you know, some of these are pretty hard. This one, it was pretty confident. It was a Dalmatian, but the thing was actually labeled cherry. So this thing is actually doing quite well. And you can actually go online and give it an image, and it'll try to classify it for you. And it's got 50 kinds of dog breeds. So I put my dog in there, and it said, you know, soft-coated Wheaton Terrier. And it was right. So it's pretty amazing. Another example, which is pretty neat, is they took one of these deep neural networks, and they hooked it up to a language model. So this task, they were asked to not just identify what's in the image, but then how things relate to each other and, you know, what's going on in the image. And on the left here are examples where the thing gets it perfectly right. Here are examples where it gets small errors, and, you know, things like this are you know, pretty amazing. You know, this guy's in the background, but, you know, not bad. But it does some pretty silly things that don't seem to make a lot of sense either. Okay, so. Yeah. So, you know, I'm going to give you an overview of how these things work. And I want to start by talking about what deep learning was in the 80s. And I want to emphasize that the next couple of slides, both in actual images and in content, come directly from Jeff Hinton, who is at University of Toronto as well as at Google. So, and he's one of the main founders of this field, and he worked on it straight through from the 80s to the present. So in the 80s, people worked on what are called multilayer perceptrons, which are feed-forward neural networks, where you put data in at the bottom, you pass it through a sequence of nonlinear transformations, and at the end, you make a prediction, a classification prediction of what's in the image or something. And if you get it wrong, you use the chain rule to backpropagate your error to tweak your weights. So this is a supervised task where the data is pairs of images and labels, and that's what you're trying to model. And it didn't really work. You might have heard until a couple of years ago that neural networks were a gigantic failure, and they were just never going to amount to anything. And there were theories about why this is. First of all, this requires a lot of labeled data, which we didn't have back then. We do now. They're fairly computationally costly when you have many layers. That's not a problem anymore. We thought that the optimization gets stuck in local optima and saddle points, so the error function in weight space is glassy in some sense. It turns out that these days we think local optima are not really a problem. It's more that there are lots of saddle points, so people are developing algorithms to figure out. Yeah.
Is it relevant to ask whether the error correction is more positive or more negative as you penalize wrong answers to a greater degree than you reward good answers?
So you're penalizing all the wrong answers in the same way, for example, in the simple case.
No, but you penalize wrong answers and you don't reward right answers?
Right, yes, in one version. That's correct.
Okay, there was some kind of paper by Per Bachman where she advocated doing the opposite.
That's right. Yeah, I know of the paper, but I don't know it well enough to say much. So people are now working on optimization algorithms that find directions to escape saddle points. And there were other technical issues about vanishing and exploding gradients as you use the chain rule many times through a deep network. So in the mid-2000s, what people decided to do was instead of going right, for the goal that you want, which is to build this classifier, they thought, let me first start with an unsupervised learning problem. One of the motivations for this is that, let's say you're trying to just learn a classifier that can distinguish, cats from dogs. If you use it as a supervised problem, every sample you're giving the algorithm exactly one bit of information, or at most one bit of information, to distribute amongst all of the weights in the network, right? But there's a huge amount of structure in the structure of the input itself. So maybe if you learn the distribution of the data as opposed to a conditional distribution of the answer given the data first, you can use that productively. So for our purposes, the kind of generative model of the data that we need is something called a belief net. And this looks like a feed-forward network in the opposite direction, where we start with some hidden causes, we sample them, and then we can do a sort of downwards pass where we generate samples here and eventually generate a sample of the actual data distribution. And with a model like this, there are two things that you generally want to do. You'd like to do what's called inference, where you put in a sample of the data here, and then conditional on that sample, you want to infer the states of the hidden units. And secondly, of course, you want to do learning, where you actually adjust the parameters on these arrows to make this belief net more likely to generate the observed data. And it turns out that these tasks are hard. So it's easy to generate from this data, but to do inference and learning, it's hard due to something called explaining away that was originally talked about by Judea Pearl, and this is an example that comes from Jeff Hinton. The basic idea being that if I have some hidden units that are independent in the prior. Once I condition on data, they can become highly correlated, and this becomes a problem. So this is a silly example that Hinton has, where you have some really rare event like your house jumps, and there are two possible causes. Let's assume that they're independent. If you observe your house jumping, it's much more likely that one or the other thing happened, but not both. So these things become strongly anti-correlated. And this really prevents you from being able to fit a model like this. So in the mid-2000s, people took a different approach, where instead of having this feed-forward directed kind of model, they used what's called a restricted Boltzmann machine. So generally, a Boltzmann machine is a model that has visible or data-like units as well as hidden units, and you have icing-like interactions between every pair of visible-visible, hidden-hidden, visible-hidden, whatever. In the restricted case, you have a bipartite graph, so you only have interactions between the two populations. So you have some energy function that looks like this. And these hidden units don't actually exist. They're just used by your model to construct the correlations in the data. So you can integrate them out and look at the resulting energy function, and it implicitly contains interactions of all different orders. So you can generate all sorts of different correlational structures in the data. And in fact, if you have a big enough population of hidden units, you can generate any binary distribution. But you might need exponentially many hidden units.
Can you say something about why it's designed such that it's restricted and not?
Yeah, so the basic reason is that if you restrict it, then you can sample from it much more easily. So if you condition on the visible, all of the hiddens are conditionally independent, so you can do block Gibbs sampling, where you generate all of these now together at once, and then go back and generate all of these, and you can do this back and forth many times to get an equilibrium sample. In practice, so you need these equilibrium samples to do learning. In practice, people use something called contrastive divergence, where they didn't even go that far. They just did a couple samples back and forth to speed things up, and that actually works really well. So you can train these models relatively easily. So what Hinton did next was a sort of greedy layer by layer training of these restricted Boltzmann machines. So he first took one of these networks, trained it on the data, fit these parameters W and the fields. And then he took all of the data and used this as a mapping from visible to a hidden population. So now he has a distribution of hidden activities. And then he took that distribution and used that as data to train another layer of a restricted Boltzmann machine. And then did it again and again. And when you do that and you put it all together, you end up with an interesting kind of hybrid model, it turns out. Where if you want to generate data from this model, you first have undirected connections up here. So you do this block Gibbs sampling back and forth many, many times. And then once you've equilibrated, you go down in a feed-forward fashion and generate a sample. And this kind of object is called a deep belief network. But of course, these are, when we were training it, these were undirected connections. So implicitly inside of this model are these upwards connections as well. And you can actually use those, and this is what Hinton did, to initialize the weights of a multilayer perceptron and then give it labels. And once you've done that, you can just do simple backpropagation to fine-tune these weights. And the idea is that hopefully you've put the weight, you've initialized the weights in a good region of weight space so that things can learn much better and it doesn't get stuck in saddle points or whatever. And just to show you that this pre-training does something sensible, you can take this object, which is learning some high-dimensional complicated function, and you can squash it down using some dimensionality reduction technique into two dimensions and look at how the function that it's computing changes as you train the weights. And if you don't do the unsupervised pre-training, you start off somewhere and the thing kind of diverges. And every different trial when you do this training, because there's noise in it, ends up diverging. But if you start with pre-training, so all the weights are initialized with unsupervised pre-training, they all kind of move coherently in the same way. So they've kind of found a groove, in weight space that they're all sort of living in.
And you're training the same feed-forward network, but you're not supervised learning in the same sense. You just initialize the weights from this deep machine. You use it once to initialize the weights, and then you send a training or testing set to it or something.
Let's see. So in both of these cases, at this point, you're only doing supervised training.
Yeah.
So you're giving the labels. But in this case, you initialize the weights just randomly. And in this case, you initialize the weights that were learned from this unsupervised layer-by-layer thing. So this is to argue that this unsupervised stage is doing something intelligent, basically. It turns out, though, in the past couple of years, basically since that big ImageNet result, people have really optimized this procedure, and they've collected huge amounts of data and thrown huge computational power at it. So you don't need this pre-training stage anymore. But if you don't have the luxury of being at Google, or you work in a field that doesn't have nearly infinite data, it's still important for those kinds of situations. But otherwise, what people do these days, at least in the sort of most standard kind of version, is similar to what people were doing in the 80s with just a couple of tweaks of better weight initialization, a smarter choice of the function that is actually being computed at these units, and better regularization, something called dropout, which is an interesting physics problem in its own right. Yeah, instead of using these sigmoid units that look like spins, they use something called rectified linear units, which seem to do a lot better. Okay, so this is great, but it's still a little bit disconcerting because there's a lot of empirical work in this field, but there's not very much theory. There's a little bit, and one of the people that's been doing a lot of it is Yoshua Bengio at Montreal, and this is a slide I took directly from him. And there are various arguments for why this scheme should make sense. One of them that is advocated by this group is the basic result that if you have two layers, you can compute any function, sure, but you can come up with functions that you can represent efficiently if you have many layers, but require exponential size if you only have two layers. So this is one argument for why you should be doing this kind of many layer training. These days people have 11, 13, 15, I don't even know how many hidden layers. But I think this kind of perspective misses one of the interesting points, which Bengio calls the emergence of disentangling. And the idea here is that as you go to higher and higher layers of the network, the hidden units become more and more statistically decoupled. And they learn increasingly independent aspects of the data. There are many different observations of this happening in sort of almost any particular kind of deep learning that you can do. But there's no real understanding of why this is. So there's a big red Y here. I didn't put this. This is Bengio's Y. The perspective that I want to suggest comes from physics, and it's we did a little bit of work on this unsupervised stage, where we argued that what you're doing is really basically the same as the 1970s version of variational RG that Kadanoff was working on. So I don't need to introduce variational RG to you guys, but basically you introduce a hidden population. Instead of mu's and sigmas, b's and h's, and you couple it to the system so that when you trace out the original microscopic degrees of freedom, you end up with an effective Hamiltonian on the hidden degrees of freedom. And if you do it in a particular way, you preserve the free energy and you have an exact RG transformation. But you want to make this tractable, so you have constraints on T so that you can actually do this trace. So in practice, you can't keep the free energy unchanged, so you can construct a variational problem where you try to minimize how much you've messed up the free energy. The analog with doing this greedy layer-wise deep learning is when you're fitting an RBM. An RBM on its own is trivially an exact RG transformation, but it's an exact RG transformation for the wrong distribution because the visible units are not representing the data correctly. So you try to tune the weights so that this exact RG transformation you have approximately reproduces the distribution on visible. So you end up with an approximate RG transformation for that reason. Just for fun, we took samples from the 2D icing model slightly above the critical temperature and did this layer-wise training for a couple of different layers. What you can then do is you can look at, take a unit from this layer here and convolve its weights all the way down to the data and ask what it cares about in the data. And you see it learns these little sort of punctate spots. And as you go all the way to the top and then look at what a unit here is looking at in the data, you see it's learned these big blocky spins. So it's kind of cute that the model learns to do a block spin transformation on its own.
1600 is the number of that are visible?
Yeah, it was just a little 40 by 40 thing. And you can use this to compress and then reconstruct. So you can take a sample, and then you can feed it in, map it up to these 25 degrees of freedom, and then map it back down and see what it does. And you start with a sample, and you can reconstruct it. And it looks pretty good. So you can get a nice sort of compression of the samples. Yeah?
I'm confused about something. The normalization group with flat spin normalization for some low dimensional lattice, you just block out nearest neighbors. And the kind of neural networks you're talking about in the learning algorithms have multiple connections and very non-local connections.
That's right. So
that's a big difference between those.
That's right. So here, I did not enforce any locality. The model had to learn locality on its own. There is a large class of networks which are called convolutional networks that build in things like translational invariance, and you can build in locality and this kind of stuff. But here I wanted to see whether it would learn locality on its own. And I should emphasize that you do this with a finite data set. So to get this kind of result, you have to put in a regularization. So I put in an L1 regularization to penalize weights. So it most of these weights are zero because of that reason. This mapping from greedy layer-wise training of RBMs to form a deep belief network to 1970s style variational RG is well and fine, but we know, as was commented on earlier, that the variational RG was never really useful for various reasons. So it may be that some of the more modern techniques that people in this room are working on could form a very nice variational onsets for doing this kind of machine learning. And I'm basically done because I anticipated more questions. So let me stop there. Thank you.
Cedric Benny, and the title of the paper is actually Deep Learning and Renormalization Group.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is basically constructs a classical probability distribution for which you can calculate the marginal distributions efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And he claims that you can learn the network efficiently.
I see. Yes, I've seen this paper, but I haven't successfully digested it. Yeah.
I was curious about why you were using numerics to study this part of the service model at the beginning. Because is it What's the mathematical understanding? Is there something like in central entropy where you know like there's some like sufficient criterion and some distributions that then you combine and you get Gaussian, you know? And then is there something like that from Zipf's law where you could say, you know, given these assumptions about, you know, my independent, you know, distributions going into it, I'm guaranteed to get a power law in these circumstances? Is there anything like that?
Let's see. So I only used numerics to try and take the data that came out of an experiment and, you know, screw it up in various ways to see, you know, how can I preserve or break the Zipf's law. But otherwise, it was just analytical arguments of that form to say, oh, if I have a generative process of this sort, then I'm guaranteed that I will get this power law with a slope of -1 under certain conditions. But if I can only get -1. If you get a different exponent, it's not this mechanism.
Can you comment more on what the hidden in the last slide? Like what?
Here?
Yeah. So what's a 25 unit layer? Like what are we expecting to see in these hidden units? Are these broad features of the visible layer that are just
That's right. Okay, so maybe I should. So there are 25 units up here, and so there are 25 different little heat maps, and each one is the effective filter, if you will, for what one of these units is looking at all the way down to the data. So this is looking at sort of a large, you know, block spin kind of section of the data, and you can't see it on here, but it does something a little bit interesting where it doesn't just learn this positive thing here. It has a slight negative halo around it. So it has a sort of what's called a center surround receptive field in neuroscience, which helps to decorrelate.
Do you get some intuition for what's the minimum number that you might need in the top layer to give faithful reconstructions?
I haven't studied that too carefully.
Yeah, is that criticality?
This is slightly above criticality.
Right,
but
so
yeah, it would depend on. Yeah.
You probably need less to encode the state or something? Like?
Maybe more because you have higher entropy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So what makes it where each one only ends up with like one hot spot? Is there some like thing you imposed on the optimization? Why aren't there some that have two that have like +1 on one of them and -1 on the other, and the other guy has the other combination?
Right, so I did not impose that. That just happens. Possibly due to the regularization that I used. And in fact, if you used this more modern regularization of called dropout, you would almost certainly end up with something like this, and not with with these weird sort of filters that are sort of compensating for each other, because it encourages the units to act even more independently.
Java means you do some training with some of the units deactivated or something?
Yeah, it means that.
Yeah,
it means that for every sample, you sparsify your network and you randomly remove a certain fraction of the nodes. You just pretend like they were never there, and this makes the network it makes all the units not be able to rely on the fact that other ones are going to be there, so they can't sort of conspire together and overfit the data.
So when you give us. When you talk about these regularizations and dropout and L1 and stuff, this comes from this literature of machine learning that is completely different than physics.
Right.
I mean, you kind of alluded to it, but is there some input that physicists are going to be able to give this structure of deep learning to maybe improve it for certain applications? Or like, what should we be looking for? What should we be trying to do in terms of this field?
Yeah, I hope so. So, you know, one thing that I think that people with your background could work on is try and do this unsupervised part of the problem with a better variational ansatz, better than these stacks of restricted Boltzmann machines.
Is there any hypothesis that natural visual systems work the way you imagine?
People talk about this over beer.
That's why I asked.
Yeah, there are qualitative senses in which it seems to be somewhat true. There is a sort of, you know, feed forward pathway, but there are also recurrent connections, and you know, things are much more complicated. The units, you know, in your brain are much more complicated than the units in here. So, you know, it's really unclear whether or not there is a real connection.
But you can be sure that the ones that didn't work were not modeled with
enough. The ones from the 80s?
Because they didn't work.
Right. I mean, now they work. You just needed, you know, an unreasonably large amount of data. You know, the other issue is that, you know, the size of the, you know, neural network in your brain that, you know, is in your visual pathway is much bigger than, you know, all the networks that people, you know, were playing with in the 80s and are still playing with now. So maybe it's something that emerges at a large scale. It just doesn't work when you have small systems.
But I guess the question is, like the chess playing algorithm. So now there are face recognition algorithms that work well enough to be used in practice.
Mm-hmm.
But that could be that they use the same algorithms that our brains use. It could be things that we don't.
Right. Okay. So maybe the best, you know, proof that they're not doing something similar is some results that people have had where they can trick these networks to say with very strong confidence that, you know, a giraffe is in the image when to you it looks like white noise. So whatever it's doing it in a different way than your brain is doing it.
Thank you.